Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolfe. In the lead up to the general election, we're looking at some of the big policy challenges facing whoever forms the next government.
And there is arguably no bigger challenge that's going to face the next government and the next Prime Minister than health. Indeed, this week, new research by British Social Attitudes, published by the King's Fund and the Nuffield Foundation, suggests that satisfaction with the NHS has reached an all-time low. So, against that backdrop, in this episode, we're going to take a look at the NHS. How much are we spending on it and with what effect? Look more closely at what the public think about it, and then move on eventually to think about the remedies for trying to turn things around.
And to help make sense of this, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Professor Sir Julian Legrand, it's a lot of titles, from the London School of Economics. Julian's a very well-known health and public policy expert, and he was a senior advisor to Tony Blair during the period of some of the Blair major healthcare reforms. And Julian was one of the first people I went and got advice from when I joined Downing Street. I hope I'm allowed to say, Julian, you gave me one of my two favourite quotes, which was, to enjoy Downing Street, you had to enjoy being a god on the outside and a slave on the inside. And I've never forgotten this.
Yes, it's very true.
The idea of you being a slave, Rachel, is inconceivable. But anyway, Julian, before we kind of get into the meat of this, maybe just like to tell us a little bit about, you know, what was life working with Tony Blair? And, you know, what was your principal role in trying to turn the NHS around after 1997?
Well, I was invited in to join the Number 10 policy unit by the person in charge of it at the time, which was Andrew Adonis. He'd read some books of mine, and he knew that I was keen on the idea of using patients to try and lever up the quality in the NHS, and particularly patient choice, so they could choose, suitably advised, they could choose which hospital to undertake their given operation in. And as a result, that would provide an incentive to the hospitals to lever up quality. On the whole, Andrew Adonis and others at the policy unit, including Tony Blair, rather bought this argument. So they invited me in to actually put my money where my mouth is, so to speak, and actually implement it.
So, Rachel, that all sounds like a rather familiar story, a picture of increased spending, but apparently not increased performance. And I think you've been digging a little bit into the more recent record of the NHS on this respect.
Yeah, I suppose it's worth saying, since we'll be talking to Julian more, that under New Labour, as he said, spending went up very, very substantially alongside with reform. So in 1997, spending as a percentage of GDP was a little bit under 7%. By 2010, it was a little bit under 10%. So spending did go up very substantially of GDP. It then stayed relatively flat under the Cameron Osborne era, going up very, very slightly. But in the last few years, partly because of COVID, but also because of promises made in the 2019 Conservative Manifesto, expenditure has increased very rapidly again. And in the last data that we have good comparisons for, it was about 11.3% of GDP in 2022. And that puts us now, for the first time, really quite high up the OECD rankings. We're used to reading that we're not a very high spender in the NHS, and that, you know, arguably been true compared to some comparator countries. That's not really that arguable anymore. We're now very high up.
I think actually we're about sixth highest, higher than we were back in 1997. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, a lot of that money has gone into people. We have far more people in hospitals than we did in 2019 and certainly in 2010. We have about 20% more nurses, about 25% more junior doctors. But quite a lot of the things that happen in hospitals have actually declined. We have fewer people being treated in accident and emergency. We have tiny increases in people being treated for what we call elective surgeries, things you book in well in advance. So exactly what Julian is describing is the dilemma that the next government is facing.
But that means that the pressure is, a lot of the money recently has gone into hospital services, and you've been focusing on hospital services. Of course, there's another whole argument about whether or not we haven't been putting adequate resources into GP funding. Maybe that's something we can come back to when we talk about possible remedies. So maybe therefore what we should now do is turn indeed to what do the public think off the back of this week's survey, given that we are spending lots of money but not getting much out of it. Well, the headline, as you may have heard out of this survey done by British Social Attitudes, is that satisfaction with the NHS has hit a new record low. It fell very, very heavily in the survey that was done in 2022. It was down to 29% people saying they were satisfied with the NHS. That figure has now fallen to 24%. And to give you some idea of how this compares, there was dissatisfaction when New Labour came into power in 1997. Only 34% were satisfied, 50% were dissatisfied. But the figures now are even worse than they were before the 1997 election, when we last had a change of government. So you can see that the public, at least, are very unhappy. And essentially, they've become unhappy since the back end of the pandemic, since we moved away from the era of protecting the NHS with a view to trying to ensure the hospitals didn't get overrun, although in so doing, we cut back on lots of elective surgery like hip replacements and knee replacements to a much greater extent than many another country, and that therefore created a backlog. But it's when we were coming out of the pandemic and the appreciation of what the decisions that had been made during the pandemic had had on the performance of the NHS in terms of particularly waiting times is when the public really began to become unhappy.
Could I just add, though, that the fall in public satisfaction occurred basically well before the onset of the pandemic. When New Labour left office in 2010, public satisfaction was the highest that it had ever been in the history of the NHS.
Yeah, but though it still wasn't bad, Julian. I mean, you know, even in 2019, you're right. I mean, by 2010, 70% of people said they were satisfied with the NHS. It was still 60% in 2019. So, I mean, it depends on how you want to look at it. But as it were, given that relatively little in the way of additional resource was put into the health service between 2010 and 2019, actually, satisfaction did hold up reasonably well, although you're right, you know, it was somewhat lower. But of course, the problem that you inherited in 1997 was undoubtedly a problem that was created by waiting times. The thing that when the same survey was looking at the issue then, and people were being asked what was most in need of improvement, the answer came back: outpatient and surgery waiting times. The thing that comes back from the survey out this week is that amongst those who are unhappy, 71% say it takes too long to get a GP or a hospital appointment. The one difference, and this is kind of one of the reasons why I mentioned GPs earlier, and we need to come back to them, is that whereas back in the late 90s, actually satisfaction with GPs was very high. It's about 75% of people were satisfied with GP services. The complaints were about outpatient and inpatient services. Now, GP satisfaction is down to 34%. It's a new record low in the latest survey. And it's GPs together with dentistry, which are now a source of dissatisfaction, while satisfaction with outpatients and inpatients is more or less back down to the relatively low levels it was in the 1990s. So in that sense, the problem now is with the NHS as a whole. And we've all heard the apocryphal stories of people trying to get a GP appointment, ringing up their GP at 8 o'clock in the morning, can't get one, etc., etc., together with the difficulty of people being able to get an NHS dentist. And that is now very, very clearly reflected in how the public are reacting. So the big, big problem that the NHS faces is to do with waiting times. And that, of course, Julian, is one of the issues that you did manage to address in the 2000s.
Indeed it was. The targets and terror regime that I was talking about earlier on was initially extremely effective, actually, in reducing. We set targets about reducing waiting times, including GPs, I may say. On the whole, those targets were met, and they were met in relatively short order. It was in about took about 2 or 3 years to bring really waiting times not down to zero, but down to a very short period. Certainly, very short as compared with the 1997 situation, or indeed the situation now. So I think, but then we did encounter a bit of a problem. I remember sitting in a meeting with Tony Blair about the reduction in waiting times in accident and emergency. We'd actually got to a situation where 98% of people who went to accident and emergency were seen, treated, or discharged or admitted into the hospital. 98% within 4 hours. Nobody had to wait longer than 4 hours for any sort of treatment.
We should say that only 60% of people get that kind of service now. That's just a comparison.
Right, okay. Exactly, indeed, that's right. And I remember the Prime Minister saying, well, do we have to do this endlessly? Do we have to crack the whip over the hospital staff, the accident and emergency consultants and so on? Do we have to crack the whip so that we attain this? Is there any way that we could actually, in some internal way of levering up quality that doesn't involve the heavy-handed actual government? This was music to many of our ears, because I think we were all getting a bit worried. There's no doubt that terror works, but it is ultimately demotivating.
And is it a bit like other forms of kind of adrenaline tests that you do on animals? It does work, but it hits diminishing returns. Once you scare the goose for the 99th time, they react a little bit less than the first few times.
That's right. It was quite common among the advisors to say, well, what terror does work, it brings up a service from abysmal to average. If you want to actually lever up the quality from average to excellent, terror is not the way to do it. And that's when we switched to this idea we added the idea of patient choice.
I think it would be really interesting to hear from Julian what changed between when he left government and this situation now, other than COVID, because we've been talking about the target regime. Where did it go? Why don't we have it anymore? We've been talking about choice that they introduced. Do we still have that? We do know on top of that, that because we've increased staffing so rapidly and so radically in the last few years, that we have more inexperienced staff. We have a far greater percentage of our staff coming from other health systems and other countries. Turnover does seem to be relatively rapid. We now have far fewer actually NHS managers per staff than we used to. So we do have some kind of staffing in the mix. What I don't know is whether Julian thinks that's been the fundamental change or if it's been something else. What's happened since you left, Julian?
Well, I think there are two things that have gone wrong. Basically, they've dropped the terror element of the targets. Some targets are still there, but the system are actually trying to ensure in real time that hospitals and others met their targets. That has all dropped away. And they've also largely dropped the element of patient choice. I mean, but again, it's still there. But the idea that actually this could act as a kind of competitive device to encourage, to provide incentives to hospitals and so on to improve their activities has gone. What we've been replaced by is, well, essentially a system going back to a kind of Soviet Union command and control, where we have 42 large monopolies that are supposed to operate in a collaborative way and organise the healthcare and indeed the social care in an area, but without any of the kind of incentives for improvement that that we introduced under New Labour.
So, Rachel, I'm spotting a bit of a paradox here. It sounds as though under New Labour, we have the creation of an internal market. It's everything's still more or less free at the point of delivery, but within the market, resources within the NHS, resources are being allocated on a competitive basis. And under a Conservative regime,
we have the most bureaucratic NHS ever created.
Bureaucratic system.
Yeah. I mean, it's really depressing.
You might be depressing, but stand back a little bit. I mean,
why has this happened?
Why do you think this has happened?
I'll give my read of the situation. I'd be really interested in Julian's. So the choice and autonomy system that Julian created, which had money following the patient, but also had these things called foundation trusts, hospitals that had quite a lot of autonomy to change what they did and borrow money. When Cameron came in 2010, Andrew Lansley, who was then the health secretary, tried to radically accelerate those reforms. And most people, Julia may disagree with this, but most people think that those reforms were kind of ill-conceived. And at the very least, those reforms through debate with the Liberal Democrats and trying to pass through the House of Commons became quite complicated and messy. And most people within the Conservative Party felt that politically it had been a catastrophe, but also were wholly unconvinced that it had ended up with good policy. The result then appears to have been under Jeremy Hunt, it's a reaction to the Andrew Lansley era, a desire to move back to collaboration and cohesion in the NHS and to respond to what I think is a genuine problem. Again, would be interesting Julian's view, that bits of the NHS aren't necessarily that well joined up. The example that's always given is people moving out of hospitals and into social care. And so he created this idea of integrated care services, which were going to join up all these bits with sort of more power in the hands of those services and more power in the hands of this body called NHS England, which was created to manage the NHS separately from the Department for
Health. So the politicians wouldn't get blamed was, I think, part of the idea.
Well, that's always stupid in my view. Whenever politicians try and create external structures so they don't get blamed, they have no levers and still get blamed. but they did this. So it seems to me that this was partly a reaction to Andrew Lansley and partly an attempt to join up bits of the NHS, but with the result that no single piece of the NHS had the ability to do anything different or respond to people. But Julian, you may disagree with all of that.
No, I agree with most of it. One bit I do disagree with is I'd love to take credit for creating the internal market, but actually I developed it, helped develop it, but actually there were many other people involved in the process and much more important than me. However, that said, yes, I think you're right. What happened when the Lansley reforms came in? One thing I've discovered about politicians working there, which John and indeed Rachel, you will both know, is politicians like legislation because it's what they do. Exactly. And Lansley was determined to sort of concretize or to embed all these internal market reforms develop them and embed it in legislation. Now, that meant that we had to fight, or that they had to fight, a whole set of battles that already had been won, in a sense. The whole idea of competition, of incentives and so on, was anathema to much of the health service. However, the debate was suddenly reopened Because actually people didn't really register the fact that, as you said, Rachel, that actually the policy had worked, there was the feeling that the policy had in some sense failed, a complete misconception, as we've already established. It meant that essentially that the battles were refought and essentially lost. And we returned to a world of command and control, a world of a sort of Soviet system of planning that had demonstrably failed in previous decades, but we were back to it with consequences that we've seen.
I think your party is saying that sometimes it's best for politicians to leave well alone.
Indeed.
I remember this really vividly in 2015 when I went into Downing Street, where the Conservatives were getting used to not having the Liberal Democrats in coalition anymore. So they had quite a small majority. And they decided to put all sorts of things into legislation, including childcare from memory. And they discovered to their horror that meant people wanted to change it. And none of it was necessary. They didn't have to put any of this stuff in legislation. They just wanted to announce something in the Queen's speech.
Exactly. It is very difficult to get continuity of policy in this sort of system.
So I think there's one other thing perhaps we should mention before we kind of go into thinking about remedies, of course, and that is we've talked a lot about how the NHS supplies its services, but of course there's also a big iceberg on the demand side, which is the ageing of our population, which has aged considerably since 1997 and is going to continue to age, even though actually, and this is arguably one of the reasons, one of the questions now to ask about our health service, is that life expectancy of birth is actually no longer increasing in the way that it's been tending to do so. But particularly the crucial problem we have is that the amount of time that people are living in good health has actually been going down a little bit more recently, and that therefore we've not only got an ageing population, but we've got a population that is ageing with more years not in good health. So, and you know, one Treasury official I know that was recently giving evidence to the House of Lords was arguing that actually looking down the track, this problem of the increasing demand for health services because of the ageing of the population is likely to pose more of a strain on our fiscal resources than is actually adjusting to net zero. I mean, it just gives us some idea of the potential scale of the challenge that will face the NHS, in a sense, irrespective of how it's run and who's in charge of it.
Well, I think that it would be foolish to deny that there is a potential problem in terms of ageing population. But it's not, in a sense, aging that fast. And it certainly can't explain the dramatic fall off in performance of the NHS in recent years. I think if we were to undertake some of the reforms, which we may discuss in a minute, I think we can cope with the aging of the population. There is, I think, a specific problem about social care, and I don't think anyone would deny that. I mean, resources are a problem. As I've indicated, that I don't think resources are a major problem for the NHS itself, but for the social care area, I think resources are a problem. And there's no doubt that if we could get that right, if we could get the social care system operating effectively, it could relieve a lot of pressure from the NHS and help towards resolving the ageing problem.
We'll be back in a moment, but first, a short break.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasiga. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes, covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate, and how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
Okay, so let's move towards remedies, but you've in a sense already cued us into one of the possible remedies, because one of the issues is that it's estimated, what, around 10% of beds at any one point in time are being occupied by people who don't know, any longer need to be in a hospital, but they need some form of care. Labour talks about a national care service, though we've had a lot of discussion about a national care service in Scotland, and it's proven to be somewhat difficult to introduce. So, I mean, what's the problem with social care, Julian? And, you know, what can we do in order to ease the pressure on the NHS?
Well, the problem essentially is, it has to be said, I'm not usually very sympathetic to resource insufficiency arguments, but in this case, I think it is fairly clear. I mean, social care suffers very badly from a lack of resources and a lack of ability to take people out of hospital. The bed blocking problem is a severe problem, and there's no doubt. So, I mean, in a sense, the problem there is probably relatively system. We do have a kind of quasi-market system in social care, so it's not really a question of what we shouldn't be doing is actually going to a kind of Soviet system of social care, providing a gigantic monopoly system of running care. But we put more resources in, and I think that will help. It won't resolve all the problems.
So I think essentially what you're saying is, as a society, we perhaps need to accept that government should be providing more of the funding for social care, and that probably also as a society, both in terms of individuals and government provision, that we need to be also spending more on this service.
I think we should be, yes.
Yeah.
And okay. This is obviously politically slightly challenging, because lots of people feel scarred by the 2017 election when Theresa May introduced a new taxation system to fund social care, and the view, at least in Westminster, is that this was pretty destructive to her electoral chances, and neither party seemed very keen on going into the next election promising either lots more money for anything or lots more taxes to pay for anything. So the chance of this being promised now seems low.
Well, certainly I think the idea of labelling a new tax is a dangerous political strategy, and as indeed we saw in 2017, as Rachel, I'm sure you're aware.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak did indeed introduce such a tax.
Well,
only for it to be done by Liz Truss.
Indeed. No, I think the idea of some sort of specific social care tax is clearly dead. We'll just have to include it as part of the general settlement on the budget settlement as an increase in resources going into there. And yes, it may well involve, it will involve an overall increase in general taxation. There are many other demands on that for the moment, as we know. But I mean, I think that's the price we have to pay. And indeed, I'm out of sympathy with the current Labour party at the moment in its reluctance to raise taxes. I think that the politics of it could be that going into an election with a promise to raise taxes and have improved public services would not be such a politically disastrous as people argue. But John, you'd have a better view of that.
You just invited me to say that one of the other findings in the British Social Attitudes data out this week is that 48% of people say that, you know, that faced with a choice between increasing taxation and spending on health or reducing it or keeping it as it is, that 48% of people say that we should increase it. So, I mean, society is divided between one half who essentially would think that we do need to increase taxation and spending on health, and another half that basically would keep it as it is. But certainly, you know, the public have not reacted particularly favourably to the tax cuts that the government introduced both in the autumn and just a few weeks ago. But let's go more widely, Julian. You've been invited back into 10 Downing Street. Let's leave aside the Covid administration. It might be a Conservative, it might be a Labour one after the election. And you're being asked, we've now got this almighty problem. What, Julian, should we do?
As I think I've indicated, I think the first step is to reintroduce targets and terror.
So lots of phone calls to NHS managers.
But with tea.
And lots of firings.
After the agent for the terror was something called the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit. That was replaced by something called the Prime Minister's Implementation Unit. It's essentially setting the targets, but without the terror, without the teeth. So we have to introduce the teeth, I'm afraid. We have to. So that's the first step, I think.
But that implies, let me just say something important politically here. That implies having a prime minister who has a high degree of authority over his or her ministers. Because essentially what you're saying is, the Prime Minister is saying, here is this delivery unit, and you, my Minister, have to be accountable to them and explain what's going on. And of course, the fascinating question at the moment is whether or not Rishi Sunak would be able to do that vis-a-vis his cabinet. And will indeed Sir Keir Starmer have that kind of authority vis-a-vis his colleagues, if indeed he is the next Prime Minister?
I wouldn't speak about Rishi Sunak. I would say, I mean, you're absolutely right. Having the Prime Minister's authority behind you is very important. As we discussed earlier, the role of being God outside of Downing Street was very powerful, and it was because Tony Blair would back up his advisers, he'd back up his ministers if they were going down a radical route. That was one of the reasons why he was really. Ultimately, I think he was a great Prime Minister.
I mean, my own view on this is that if Keir Starmer goes into Downing Street in 2024 with a massive majority and does not have any authority over his own colleagues, he's the most incompetent politician who's ever existed. I mean, that's just not a plausible scenario. He will have authority. It's whether he uses it.
I certainly get the impression that he's more in the Tony Blair mould than in, let us say, the David Cameron mould. Rachel would be better able to answer this than me, but he was seen to be more of the chair of the board role rather than the chief executive, which was much more the role that Tony Blair took, and one would hope that the next Prime Minister will take.
So the other things that Labour Party do talk about at the moment, Julian, is basically more evening operations, more weekend activities, try to get the waiting times down that way. Is that a feasible long-term strategy or not?
Well, I think there probably is some scope for the greater use, more generally, of AI, of artificial intelligence, or indeed even less advanced forms of telecommunication and so on. It was quite interesting. There was a survey recently about the patients' attitudes towards GPs having online consultations. And on the whole, the hysteria that was generated by ministers, particularly about how terrible it was that GPs were going down the online route, seems to have been misplaced, that actually many patients seem quite happy with online. And there's no doubt that's a far more efficient way, both for the patient as well as the GP, of allocating. So I think that there probably are some routes down there, the route of better use of technology to improve things. In doing so, one must bust some myths, like the myths about online consultations.
And we're a bit short of things like MRI scanners and things like that as well by international standards.
We could do with more of those. We certainly could do with more of those. And they would make a difference, a fairly marginal difference, I think. But nonetheless, they would make a difference.
I mean, it is worth maybe putting one of the defences that the people who run the health system would have right now to what you're saying, which is, this is completely feasible without much more money. We need to introduce more targets and terror, and then we need to introduce more choice, which is that I think the term they use is the NHS always runs hot, that we have too few beds, too little equipment, given the number of patients that we're serving, and that actually only with very substantial capital investment is it plausible that we're going to be able to start clearing this backlog.
Well, there's data which, Rachel, I know that you're familiar with, showing that there's been substantial increases in the actual volumes of the numbers of staff, and indeed, particularly in recent years. But at the same time, the numbers of operations and so on, the number of activities, is basically flat or indeed even falling. So it looks as though there is actually considerable capacity at moments, at least at the hospital end of the service. So I don't think that's really an issue. I think there is a capacity problem at the GP level.
Well, I was going to say, because we focused a lot on hospitals, but you know, in contrast to 1997, the problem for the public, at least, is also with the GPs. And again, one of the things that it's being argued and Labour seem to be interested in is that perhaps, insofar as there is prospects of more resource, is that it should be focused on community services, including GPs, rather than necessarily on hospitals. Because in a sense, what we really need to do is to treat people before they need hospital treatment. So we need to try, and that therefore there's an argument that more focus on community services is the way in which we should go.
Well, I think there's something to that, and I particularly in the area of GPs. But again, of course, it takes a long time to train a new GP, and getting more GPs is not an easy business, unless we actually plunder the third world in order to get more primary care doctors. And actually, often third world doctors are not necessarily the right kind of training and so on for operating at the GP level.
One of the challenges that somebody might put to you, Julian, is of course that the world of dentistry and of GPs has always been a world of competition and an internal market.
Well, yes and no. There wasn't really much going. GPs often actually had little boundaries around the areas in which they were allowed to observe, and they were not really operating in a very competitive world. And dentistry is a whole other story, but I don't suspect we haven't got time to go into that.
We'll bring you back for dentistry. It is probably worth just saying, and then I want us to kind of close, really honing down on what you would do, that GPs, unlike hospitals, have seen some improving productivity. We have fewer GPs, but we do actually have increased treatment of GPs, which suggests that maybe one of the reasons people are dissatisfied with GPs is because of a knock-on effect from hospitals that are making it much more difficult for GPs to sort of clear their way through. So these are interconnected. But I just before we finish, Julian, because we could do 10 episodes on the NHS and probably should. Broadly, I think what you're saying is that if you went into Downing Street now and you were advising Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting, what you would say is, number one, make the hospitals frightened again. Start introducing targets and terror and be willing to fire them. Then number two, I think bring back some of those elements of choice and competition and autonomy in the hospital system. But three, we do need to look at GPs on one end of the system and social care on the other system if we want hospitals to work better. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
It is. I think, and the central argument behind it all is what I often tell my students, which is incentives, incentives, incentives. That actually simply pumping money into things, into public services, well, and this applies in areas like education and social care as much as it does in health, simply pumping more resources in will not achieve the results you want. You have to have some kind of pressure, some kind of incentives for people to reform. And that there could be a negative incentive like terror. It could be a positive incentive like getting more money through taking on more patients. But one way or another, you've got to have some kind of incentive to drive reform and to make sure that some of the problems that we've seen currently in the NHS will be resolved.
And Julian, I should, because I know you've written about this a lot, I should finish by saying, you know, lots of people listen to this and say, but nurses and doctors are doing this for the right reason. They work so hard. They really care about patients. Why are you saying that you need to frighten them or pay them more to make them do better? And I think your book was called Knights and Knaves on this. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I think the reason why people work in public services is complicated. They have a set of concerns about their about the people they're trying to benefit, the patients, the pupils in the case of teachers, and so on. However, they've got their own living to earn. I mean, we're seeing it now with the case of the junior doctors, of people really concerned about their own position. So I think what you need is an incentive system that appeals to both what you might call the knight and the knave, both the altruist and the egoist, the person who's concerned about, because like doctors, like everybody else, and including yours, are both. We're both concerned with our self-interest, the interests of our family and so on, but we're also concerned with the interests of the people we're trying to serve. You need a clever system that will actually appeal to both.
So, Julian, I think that this is the most optimistic of these policy sessions we've done, because you can look at this and see this inexorable rise in health spending in an environment of basically zero GDP growth and say this is impossible. We can't keep increasing at this rate because we can't afford it. And what you are saying is actually we could do more with what we have, and we have successfully done that before. John, Are you going to maintain the silver lining, or are you going to bring us back down to earth as we finish?
Not at all. I mean, I think the point is that, in a sense, one of the reasons why it's been fascinating to talking to Julian is that, you know, they did take over a health service that was struggling to a degree and did manage to turn it around. I mean, I think, in fairness, one has to say, both by putting in more money and getting it to be spent more effectively, it was a double-pronged strategy. The challenge now is greater because it's not entirely clear that we can put in much more money, and the difficulties for the health service are greater. But, you know, if the ship was turned around once, then presumably it could be turned around again. And there are equally opportunities, such as we mentioned, more scanners, AI, digitalisation, which, you know, can sometimes sound like pie in the sky. But perhaps we will actually be able not only... The NHS, I should remember, is always providing more and better treatments, and that's part of the reason why costs rise, but that means we get better patient outcomes. But perhaps there are also things clearly on the horizon that we can do that would mean that we will actually be able to get more out of the service without perhaps putting in an increase in resources of the scale that New Labour managed to do back in the 2000s.
Julian, thank you so much for joining us. I very much hope that they invite you in 2025 to fix this. But for now, that's it from Trendy for this week. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis. Next week is Easter, so Rachel and I have been given a week off. But we'll be back the week after that. Oh, and of course, by then, the local elections will be within sight.
Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasagar. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes, covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate, and how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.